Station number 11740, Lewis Hoskins, Reel 4.
Lewis Hoskins, Reel 4.
The situation I was talking about was the American elections were coming up the first week of November, and those of us who were based in Shanghai were talking with Americans and some military observers and so forth, and we were reading Time magazine. So we were thoroughly convinced that Mr. Dewey was going to be elected and that Truman would be out. Marshall would be out, Leighton Stewart would be out, and the support picture in China, no longer on a coalition policy, but supporting the Kuomintang. That was our persuasion. And so I used that. I said, you have one more chance to try for a coalition government to end the terrible civil war where there's so much suffering. So many children and families are being killed and disrupted by the civil war. In our judgment, if you can transfer your campaigns into the political arena, you'll still win without all that suffering. But this is your last chance to try again for a coalition government, and you'll have to take the initiative because we don't think it'll happen from the Kuomintang. But do so before November. Dewey would have said, if I didn't know you were a Quaker and a pacifist, I think you were set up as a stooge of Chiang Kai-shek, but I know you aren't. I know you're sincere. But what makes you think that Dewey's going to be elected? And I said, well, all the evidence we have suggests that he's going to have an overwhelming victory in November, and all these things were happened that I tell you about. He said, I don't think Dewey's going to be elected. And I said, what do you mean? Do you think Wallace is or the Truman will be elected? There were three candidates that year. He said, the laboring man will not elect Dewey. The laboring man of America will not elect Dewey. And even if I'm wrong, the Secretary of Treasury, Senator Taft, will not pour any more money down the rat hole of Chiang Kai-shek. I said, well, you may be right, but I still think this is the time to make it where you can be sure of support. And I said, not only can you count on the American ambassador, but I've met the British ambassador, Sir Ralph Stevenson, the French ambassador. I think the whole international community would support you. And he said, I will, of course, give this serious consideration and I appreciate your concern because we don't want to continue the war any longer than possible, but we must win. By then it was 4:30 in the morning because this takes time. I've said it quickly, but through interpretation. Our interpreter, and he had his interpreter, who was an old friend of mine, who became the first American first ambassador to America. And so I think we had pretty good understanding of each other. And what he said was so plausible that I have long reflected on both his intelligence and his information sources. So we bid our adieus because he had to get back before daylight to his headquarters. So we went back to our village, well, it was actually there, and tooled up and slept. And then started back and had relatively little incidents in getting back, except we had to go back into Kuomintang territory, having been in the communist territory for a couple of weeks, and that made us very suspect crossing the Yellow River. So we used our ploy of Calazar. We've been investigating Calazar, and there's a lot of it up there in the communist territory that we'll have to worry about, so forth, and we tucked our way back in. And I eventually got back to Nanjing and reported to Dr. Stewart as well as to our group. And he said, I wish you'd spend the night. I want to do a little checking. So I stayed overnight at the embassy. So that's very interesting, and it may begin to explain something that we can't figure out what happened last week. This was 3 weeks after I'd actually been talking to Deng Liu before I got to Nanjing, because we changed hands to move on another several times using our passes and so forth as the area became more engulfed in the war. And the next day he said, yes, I think I know now. There was a great flurry in the legislative yuan about 10 days ago, and we could not figure out what was going on. There was a lot of toing and froing and debating and people off in little corners and so forth. And they were very secretive. They wouldn't tell us a thing. But this morning, my colleagues had found out, yes, we think pretty sure there was a new offer from the communists for some sort of a deal. Obviously, it wasn't a very attractive deal because it was turned down immediately, coldly, by Chiang Kai-shek. And what he said was, no need for me to do this. I will soon be rescued by President Dewey's election. I don't know whether that amounted to anything or not. And with General Marshall, I'd have to say they were a long ways apart. And by that time, the communists knew they had the upper hand. It was just a matter of time. They were in our territory. They were pushing down towards Nanjing. The Battle of Suzhou came up very shortly, and so forth.
That was a very vigorous piece of peacemaking, wasn't it, Lewis?
It was an attempt. We had no leverage, but our concern and the respect that we had as a group earned enough to get a degree of confidence.
That, I think, is a very important point, isn't it? The fact that, you know, as conscientious objectors, and you have already indicated that the communists knew that you were pacifist,
yeah,
in as much that that was, you know, cited as a factor.
Well, both sides knew that, and I just add one more instance. While I was being delayed on our return to the Yellow River area, our field headquarters changed hands, I think, six times in that fortnight. I couldn't get away because it kept changing back and forth. And a whole group of Kuomintang soldiers, all mechanized and militarized and spit and span and uniforms and so forth, came into Jingmu and demanded our quarters for their general. And we said, no, I'm sorry, we cannot let you... We need this. We cannot give it to you. Now, if you take it, we won't resist. But we really need it. We don't want you to take it over. And he was so nonplussed, he said, well, what can I do? I said, go down to the Shenjiangfu, which is the county courthouse. There's a lot of facilities down there, which is what they did in the end. But then later that day, he sent his aide up and said, I wonder, I tried to explain why we couldn't cooperate. I wondered if your principals would permit you to loan us some rice. Our supply wagons have not arrived yet, but they'll be here tomorrow and we'll repay it. I said, sure. So we gave them the food. And they stayed the better part of a week when they suddenly fled. And our Chinese members went down front and said, the communists are coming. And sure enough, they came that afternoon, all three of them on horses, had tea with us. And the three of them had been enough of a freight for the Kuomintang to pick up their trucks, their lorries, their wagons, their jeeps, and escape. This did not impress me very highly as the effectiveness of a mechanized, semi-mechanized, militarized, westernized military as compared to the more guerrilla, mobile soldiers of the communists, the 8th Red Army. The three sentries were soon followed by a large force, and they came in and checked around, asked the peasants whether these foreigners were abusing them, whether they ought to be kicked out or what, and we were apparently given a good enough score that they saw a hospital functioning with Kuomintang peasants, Kuomintang soldiers side by side. And so they cooperated. But they said, you better evacuate any of your supplies from Kaifeng, which was about 30 miles away. We're going to be capturing Kaifeng in the next few days. And without warning, we took our trucks, which now included several that UNRWA had left behind, and drove into Kaifeng through an ambush, which again our passes helped us through, and loaded up extra petrol and medical supplies that we'd stored there, and got back to Jammu just before the Kuomintang morning reconnaissance flights took over. And we were then under communist control, and from there on. But while we'd had some difficulty at the very beginning, neither army really gave us serious difficulties once they understood who we were and what we were doing, and had checked it out with the local people. And it's not because what we were doing at that moment was so important, it was that we had done enough for the village people here, there, and everywhere that we were respected, even though we were an international foreign group, not just American, but an international foreign group without ever carrying any weapons, sometimes in funny kind of uniforms, but helping the people whatever way we could. And that was our protection.
It must have been a very delicate situation, and very delicately handled, when you think of the nature of the communists and the Kuomintang from 1948 in particular, that you were sort of walking that tightrope.
I should say that by this time the French ambulance unit had reduced its support and turned it over to the Quakers as the major management factor in the American Bread Service Committee, while we continued to get FAU young chaps. Because of the changing nature of our work, it was more than just medical ambulance and supplies and things like that, but it was really general service. We changed our name, both in Chinese and English, to the French Service Unit. But for most of us, it made very little difference. It just explained why we were doing social and technical assistance and refugee rehabilitation, as well as hospital reconstruction and restaffing and so forth. But by this time, the Civil War was inevitable. And the victory in the Civil War was very clearly inevitable for the communists. And they were pushing further and further south. And we didn't know how much further suffering would be involved. We came along after the Suzhou-Fo War and helped to deal with the casualties of that particular battle. We're ready to move on down towards Nanking and Shanghai. But it happened so fast we couldn't keep up. And there was a collapse. The national government, the Kuomintang Party leaders left. But we continued to be in Shanghai. Accepted the advice of the embassy and so forth, we were urged to take families home. So I'd been there 3 years, and well, it was almost two. We now had two daughters, and so it was thought wise for us to return to America. And there were still young people who were willing to stay on. The structure was continuing. We were confident that the Kalazar campaign was coming to a successful conclusion. We had invited both governments to send in medical teams with train and hand over equipment. The Kuomintang never showed up. The communists did, and we turned our equipment over to them. And on later tours, we discovered that they had made good use of it, and Kalazar is now gone, thanks to our efforts and those that the Chinese continued with. Towards the end of November, it seemed right for us to come home. And the unit council agreed to it with the proviso that instead of taking a nice leisurely freighter by way of England to America, that one of us at least would fly straight home and try to interpret what we saw happening to the American people in any way we should, tying into the peace education work that Quakers had been doing all through the war and after the war. And so I agreed to take Terry, our elder daughter, and Lois would bring Laurie, our Shanghai-born daughter, home on a Navy repatriation ship. So Terry and I flew straight home at the beginning of November, and I left her with my parents in Oregon and flew right on to Philadelphia and on to Washington. I also had a personal communication from Leighton Stewart to Secretary of State George C. Marshall, because he said my reports, my diplomatic pouch is not getting to my friend George Marshall, and I don't know that it'll do any good, but will you try to get this private letter to him? So within a week I was in Washington trying to get to George Marshall, but I was unable to succeed in getting it to him. He was so protected by what I call the China lobby, people in government and in Congress who were still supporting Chiang Kai-shek and later Taiwan, and had discounted what Leighton Stewart was saying, so much so that he felt frustrated. I was told by Leighton Stewart, if you cannot deliver this by such and such a date, it was about 2 weeks after I'd left Nanking, Nanjing, with him, as he destroyed it, because it should not go to anybody but George Marshall, and it would be out of date in a fortnight. So I destroyed it, and I don't know what it said, although I have some guesses. And I don't know whether it would have made any difference if I'd gotten to Marshall. He was a little under the weather, they said. No, it wasn't coming into his office, which may or may not have been true, but I never did get to see him. But I did contribute whatever I could then to effort on the part of Quakers to talk about a realistic foreign policy in China without much success, because the China lobby and the Taiwan lobby took over, and American policy was hostile to the communists and continued to be involved and supported economically with the Kuomintang and Taiwan. And the 30 years of lack of communication was largely to the result of that.
When you heard about the events of 1949 and the formation of the People's Republic, one imagines from what you have been telling me that you couldn't have been that surprised.
We knew it was coming. We didn't know how soon. The collapse was a little more sudden than might have been expected. The October 1st date seemed to us inevitable and basically good for the Chinese people. This didn't mean we were accused of being communist if we said that, but we were concerned that we could see the deterioration of the Kuomintang in morale, in ethics, and effectiveness. We could see the relative effectiveness as a government in the liberated areas. The biggest difference, is most striking, is the degree of inflation in the Kuomintang, which we felt very keenly during the last year or so. And there was none of that in liberated areas. I still have some liberated area money that I could probably take to China today and have it acknowledged as valuable, I don't know. But they were able to control inflation. They brought better health facilities, generally better off conditions for the farmers in the areas that they had any long control of. Now, there were a lot of people who fled, of course, refugees, landlords, business people who were afraid. And what was left were welcoming the stability and the relative ease of economic situation which the communists brought. Didn't know anything about Marx or Lenin or very much about Mao Zedong's own thinking, that they just wanted to be left in peace to do their job. And the communists were doing a better job of letting them do that than the Roman dominant. So to that extent, we saw this as a new mandate of heaven for the Chinese people. But we didn't have much success persuading the American people, nor did some of the diplomats that were saying the same thing, but were eased out, including Dr. Stewart.
This experience in China, you know, what was it to have lasting effects on your life, do you think?
Yes, you can probably guess that. I've always been interested in international, and I've always been interested in anything that can contribute to peace for the United Nations and whatever. But it was a very, and is, a very formative part of my life, and seldom away from my mind. I've gone on to other areas when I couldn't get back to China. I developed other concerns, Quaker interests and so forth, related to the service committee and so forth. But China has a particular warm spot in the Chinese people, in my heart and that of our family. So we were glad when we were invited back in 1978 as members of the medical team 19 to see what had been achieved, and we were impressed with the tremendous gains in health and medical services over that 30 years. And we were delighted to get back to some of the places where we had worked and find a few people who remembered us and appreciated us and were open to us. We were delighted when we were able to send medical supplies such as heart pacers and heart valves to the Ministry of Health fairly recently. And to go back a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, to spend a year teaching with Chinese young people.
Do you still have the same faith, you know, that the equipment and resources that are sent there are being used as effectively? You know, do you still have faith in China?
In the Chinese people, yes. Governments and parties, I can say I have comparable faith. But I was able to, for instance, check up on some of the heart pacemakers that had been installed and reporting and what we'd seen was very impressive and very responsible and carried out non-politically and well. So I have a great deal of faith in the young people and their aspirations for future leadership. I'm afraid, like other regimes in China, this regime has its problems of graft, corruption, and nepotism and favoritism. So I am at the moment a little bit discouraged for the near future, but not for the long range. And I don't know how long the long range is away from us, but I suspect China will have the same resilience. The Chinese people with the same resilience and abilities will get through whatever comes in this particular period, as they did from the terrible Cultural Revolution. There have been these swings, but they survived. They're going to find their way, I'm pretty sure. And there's still a few people we know here and there in prominent positions that we had known for a long time, or young people when we were there in the 40s. And I have faith in their integrity and their vision. And encouraged by the young students who have a vision for their country and pride in their nation. And a fairly critical and objective view of the ills and the problems and the flaws in the party and in the government that they now see. They want to come to the West, but they want to return, I think, to be selective about what they can contribute to an even greater China. And that's as it should be.
Your peace work is still ongoing, I imagine, Lewis, isn't it?
Well, we're retired, and so we can't do as much, but we're working on relationships wherever we can. We're concerned not only with China, but with South Africa, with the Middle East, with Latin America, and try to play a responsible role, even though in our elderly retirement, we can't be as active. But as citizens, we have quite a bit that we feel we can do in the local community and so forth.
Do you think yourself there's a greater understanding in America today about people who are against war?
Yes, I would say it fluctuates. It can be whipped up a military spirit, but there is, I think, a greater feeling that peace and negotiation in the United Nations are better ways to go than bluff and military threats. So I feel a slow growth and therefore an encouragement of a better international attitude on the part of the American people. I hope we can continue to contribute with more young people coming up as COs and so forth.
Well, I think that's the signal for us to end, don't you? And thank you very much indeed, Lewis, for telling me about your very interesting experiences and reflections. Thank you.
You're very welcome indeed. Hope it's of some value to other young people who have similar privileges to what I've had.